You are not the president or the vice president's lawyer.
He won a case, a big case.
Your loyalty is not to me.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many.
It's to the law.
Well, I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. I spoke to him yesterday briefly.
The Constitution.
He's a very good attorney, and he has been my attorney.
People of this nation to guarantee justice.
Which makes me perhaps the most innocent man anywhere in the history of the United States.
This is Josh Barrow, columnist for Insider and host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about the legal problems of presidents and their associates, because all presidents have legal problems, but some have more legal problems than others. My co-host Ken White is on a much-deserved vacation this week, on which he is still following the Avenatti trial closely, so he really deserves this vacation. And I'm going to talk this week with Ryan Riley, who's senior justice reporter at HuffPost. We've been following Ryan's reporting on the Capitol rioters for the last 7-plus months, the investigations and the prosecutions of the rioters. And before that, Ryan's coverage of all the Trump Justice Department legal news with Michael Flynn and Roger Stone, all the way back to the Mueller investigation. Ryan has been indispensable covering these stories, and he's here with me today. Hello, Ryan.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So one thing we talk a lot about on this show is what a remarkable logistical undertaking these Capitol riot investigations and prosecutions are. The hundreds of cases to be brought in one federal court district, a very large fraction of the usual volume of total criminal cases that might be brought in Washington, D.C. in a given year. What does that look like to you on the ground? I mean, even just for you as a reporter, does this leave time for the other Justice Department coverage that you would normally be doing?
That's a good question. Not always. It doesn't. I mean, this is a pretty overwhelming task. I think that you know, has both sort of consumed my beat and is making things very difficult for the Justice Department just in terms of deploying resources. You know, this is just something that is enormous on the scale of things and isn't something that the Justice Department is used to handling. It's also, I think, a logistical challenge behind the scenes because it doesn't, you know, we sort of have this image, I think, of the FBI, or at least a lot of Americans have this image of the FBI as the sort of the savvy crime fighting, you know, very technologically advanced bureau. And in reality, it's a bureaucracy that can sometimes be a little bit slow to catch up. And I think that that's really shown some of the cracks over the course of this investigation, because if you look at what some of the online sleuths are doing to try to determine who is actually behind the parties responsible for a lot of these attacks and sort of hunting down the rioters, it's really impressive, and it often takes months for the FBI to catch up to cases that are pretty obvious, you know, or there were pretty obvious back in February and March and April. There's a couple of stories I've sort of had a hold on for a while, and stories I'm awaiting an arrest on. I know that it's in the FBI's hands, and I know that they're sort of on it, but it's just been taking so long to get to arrest that it is this sort of situation that's kind of odd, where you're like, okay, what's going on with this case? This one's pretty obvious. You know, I could write up an affidavit on my own right now to show you why this person is clearly behind what happened, but it is a really slow grind in a lot of these cases. And I think that's, you know, clearly the cracks are showing as this investigation goes on.
How much of that is about the FBI being slow and ponderous, and how much of it is just about the enormous volume of cases that you have here? I mean, you have all of these cases, some of which are pretty serious cases, some of which are not terribly serious cases, and those are the ones we're starting to see pleading out first. They're simple. You have people pleading guilty. In some cases, they're getting no jail time at all because all they're pleading to is that they unlawfully entered the Capitol building, didn't necessarily do anything additional of importance once they were inside there. So I assume one reason that it might take a while for the FBI to move on some of these cases is that they have other higher value targets that they have to prioritize at this time, that they have to move through this enormous number of total cases.
Yeah, you know, you'd think that there'd be some sort of prioritization going on here and they'd put the most serious cases up first, but it's really not the case. There are a lot of very serious cases that are sitting out there right now, and some of the cases that are coming in are just, frankly, the really easy sort of layup cases where someone posted on social media, they sort of built a case on their own based on their own social media activity, and someone turned them in very quickly back in January. The harder, more cases against people who are more violent, there's still a ton of them sitting out there, some of whom haven't been identified, some of whom have been identified. And I think that what more explains sort of why we're getting this mixed bag of cases as we continue is basically the structure of the FBI and the structure of the Justice Department. So this is an investigation pretty much like no other in that it touched every field office in the country. Every FBI field office has been involved in some way in this investigation. So you're getting into these little fiefdoms in various parts of the country, and which have their own priority tracks, have their own politics, have their own priorities and other casework that they need to take care of, and may have their own sense of why we're trying to go after more minor cases when we have more serious crimes sitting out there. There might be some resistance in some of these field offices. And I think that really explains why we've seen this mixed bag, because each one of these cases is going through a different field office, and they have to have the resources not only to go through with the investigation, but also to make that arrest. And some of these arrests are taking place in very remote parts of the country. And just think about all of the work and the advance work that goes into making arrests, even for a misdemeanor crime. Really, the major failure here is that no one was prepared to make those arrests on the spot on January 6th. And because of that, there's just this enormous amount of work that has to go into this. And they have to secure all of these, they have to secure so much and just prepare for those arrests as well.
So that's interesting. I mean, these court cases are happening in Washington, D.C., but because the suspects came from all over the country and are all over the country, you have this involvement all over the place. The FBI has, what, about 35,000 employees? Do you have a sense of what fraction of them have at least some involvement in this case, even if they're not dealing with it every day, that it somehow touched them because they had to handle the investigation or arrest related to some person in their district?
Yeah, they've been a little bit opaque about the numbers, and often in some of these FBI affidavits, they're hiding the names of the agents who are actually signing them. But what we do know is that, I mean, it's definitely safely within the hundreds. Probably a safe bet that it's within the thousands of people who have worked on this in some capacity. I would say that this has touched people who have worked on all different kinds of cases. You have people who typically work gang cases, who typically work drug cases, who typically work child exploitation cases. You pretty much have the span of what the FBI does and the work that the FBI does all sort of compressed into this. There are a lot of domestic terrorism prosecutors, of course, as well, and a lot of domestic terrorism FBI agents who focus on domestic terrorism. But this is pretty much touched everywhere, especially in the FBI field office, where this has basically taken over the FBI field office to a large extent, because a lot of things still are being run out of D.C.
So is this interfering with the other work that the FBI needs to be doing? And I know they've come and they've asked for more money specifically for domestic terrorism. But, even if that money is appropriated by Congress, it surely takes some time to scale up. How is this, are we seeing this throughout the courts and throughout the investigative system, that needing to move this through the snake is sort of getting in the way of everything?
It is. We haven't seen any direct evidence of that so far. One thing that I don't want to imply something that we don't know for sure, but I would just note that we had the first shooting and killing of FBI agents during the course of this investigation. It was not related to a January 6th case, but you just got to imagine in the background and the strain that this was putting on the FBI. And there will be investigations into that. That's something that when FBI agents are shot, it's something that they're going to look at and see what they could have done better. But you've got to imagine in some capacity, because of the enormous strain that this investigation was taking, that there could have been an impact on the preparations for this raid in this sort of other case. So I think that while the FBI is going to be hesitant to say that this is impacting our broader work, it certainly is an enormous investigation that is taking up a lot of resources on the DOJ side as well. That's why we have a lot of prosecutors from all over the country who've been sort of assigned on a detail to work with the DC federal prosecutor's office for a while. And some of those details are going to expire before this investigation is complete, because this investigation is going to be going on for a very long time. If they actually want to arrest everyone who was in the Capitol building and everyone who committed violence outside, which is sort of the line that they've drawn, that's going to, maybe we're halfway there, but there's a lot more arrests to come on this.
So there's been, I believe it's 610 is the number of people who've been charged so far. And they think that there's a total of somewhere around 1,200 people who committed crimes that they could charge under those guidelines.
The rough number of people who actually entered the Capitol and they believe committed some violence and were involved in some way in the siege, they've actually pegged at around 2,000 in some capacity. I don't think that that's the total universe who's going to be charged. I think it's going to be a smaller number who is charged because, frankly, the people who actually put in any thought and work into protecting their identities and weren't bragging about it on social media, had their face covered, are going to be a little bit tougher to find out and it's going to take a lot more work. Even though the FBI does have these sort of dumps from these cell phone towers where they might be able to get a number, that's not definitive enough to prove that, okay, this phone was in that vicinity, but was this person the person who actually committed that crime? Because remember, the phones that they're getting, on the inside, it's a little bit easier, but on the outside, all of those phone numbers that they're going to get, I mean, there were plenty of people there who, there are thousands of people there, and those individuals aren't off, most of them aren't going to be charged because DOJ has sort of set aside the trespassing charge there because it would just be too much for them to take on. I think that, you know, this is... Like I said, it's going to be a strain, but there's going to be a point, I think, where we're going to see more of a plateau in these cases as they go forward. I wouldn't want to say definitively where we end up on numbers. I've heard, you know, people have told me that they think that it's going to pass 1,000. People have said it's going to putter out before 1,000. I think 1,000 might be somewhere in that sweet number. I would be surprised if we don't eventually. I'd be shocked if we don't eventually pass 800, because 800 alone is just people who entered the building.
It's a huge number of cases. Another open question is how many of these will actually become trials? Because as we're talking about the resources of the federal court system and the Department of Justice, it's a lot more work to take one of these cases to trial than to plead it out. And when you have a political situation like this, where you have a lot of defendants who are ideologically motivated, one thing that Ken and I have been talking about is that makes the defendant more likely than average to actually take the case to trial. What are we seeing with that so far? Are we seeing shifts in the legal strategies that mirror the shifts in some of the political conversation around the riot, as you have more Republican politicians saying that this is overblown and that these people are even political prisoners? Is that showing up in rhetoric in court, and is that showing up in strategies where you have defendants saying, "Well, I'm going to take this to trial because it's not right that I should have to plead out here"?
Oh, you definitely are going to have a lot of people who are ideologically motivated who want to take this all the way out. One thing I would note with this talk about the people who are being held pre-trial, one thing that you will definitely notice is that politicians are not going into the details of who is actually being held pre-trial, because other than maybe a couple of cases, you're gonna like that's not someone you want to stand up for when you actually look at what they did. The people who are being held pre-trial overwhelmingly have committed violence. There are a couple on the margins, I think, who might honestly be locked up because of some bad lawyering, but I don't think that there's really this argument to be made that these people were not engaged in any violence. And it is sort of one case that I covered that did not get enough attention at the time was actually in the first during Trump's inauguration in 2017. There was sort of a black bloc that had formed, and there was a lot of violence being done in downtown D.C. or property destruction, and things were thrown at police officers. But the police response to that was to grab everyone in there, kettle them, make mass arrest over 200 people, and they threw the book at those people, right? And the first case that went to trial there, all the prosecutors said they actually admitted they had no evidence that they committed any property destruction, and they followed them throughout the entire thing. These people didn't actually commit any property destruction, and the feds ended up sort of washing out on these cases because they tried to charge them. They really tried to overcharge them. So whenever I hear these claims about, oh man, there's real overreach against these Trump supporters, it just doesn't line up with the facts. You can't make that argument in any good faith, because that's not what they're being treated, I think, a lot better than, you know, the anti-Trump protesters were treated back in 2017.
Well, you also have the odd circumstance here where you had the rioters documenting their own criminal acts, or documenting the criminal acts of people around them. I mean, I don't know about the specific circumstances of those Black Bloc actions, but generally the left-wing riots that we have seen have been done, I think, by people who are a little bit savvier about trying not to be identified and trying not to have the crimes that can be specifically tied to them back all over the internet. So I assume that's one thing that makes, in many of these cases, the charging decisions easier here, right? And we'll talk about some of the investigative techniques in a moment, but this has been very unusual for the sheer volume of documentary evidence that is available of what happened on January 6th.
Completely, because these people thought that they were patriots, right? They were proud of what they were doing. It is kind of, you have to think there's a little bit of humor here. And if they just adopted some of the tactics of Antifa, which they condemn, they would have had a lot better of a time getting away with it. But they were bragging openly and not wearing masks when there was a mask mandate in place. You know, during that trial that I covered, the sort of Antifa or Black Bloc trial from Trump's first inauguration, prosecutors explicitly argued that wearing a mask was part of the criminal conspiracy, right? So it was just sort of this juxtaposition between that and now where we are today. When we were in the middle of this coronavirus pandemic, there was a mandate to wear a mask. You had every excuse to wear a mask, but a lot of people refused to do so. So it was sort of like, you know, telling on yourself and getting yourself caught to own the libs.
There is one associated case with this, but before we turn and talk about some of the online investigation, that sort of thing, there's somebody who left two pipe bombs on January 5 outside the Republican and Democratic National Committee buildings. And there are some pictures of someone, the sneakers that he's wearing can be identified, but otherwise you can't really get a good look at who he is. And we don't, do we know much of anything about that case? It's sort of this eerie thing that someone tried to commit this serious terror attack. And fortunately, the bombs didn't go off. But it seems like that, in that case, where you didn't have the guy Instagramming about what he was doing, we seem to have no idea what happened there.
Yeah, and it took away resources from the police response, I think, is a major component of this. This is one of the reasons that the lines weren't as strong as they could have been, because this was simultaneously happening, the discovery of this these two pipe bombs, as well as this attack on the Capitol. So it diverted a lot of the attention that could have been more focused on the Capitol when this ongoing attack was unfolding. I definitely think that's a case where you could pretty safely say that investigation has been impacted by this massive criminal response, this massive FBI response to the broader Capitol riot. Because if you look at like cases that the FBI has taken up before, they'll really dive into the details. And of course, the bombs have been analyzed and they're trying to look for the components and find those different measures. But I mean, just resource-wise, it's not getting the type of attention that you would think that a bomb would get in the nation's capital, right? Like that would just be getting a lot more public attention for one thing. There is a separate component that's been set up to sort of handle this investigation. But I mean, there were definitely some missed opportunities there, because one thing that really shocked me was a few weeks after the FBI put out this other call for videos from the area. And if you look at the retention on, say, your average Ring camera that someone in the neighborhood would had and how long that video saves, they were outside of that frame. And then they were going to the public and saying, hey, if anyone has video. So the only thing you can hope for there is that someone adjusted their Ring settings or adjusted whatever settings on the camera that they might have in the area and had a longer retention than was typical, or this is the standard practice for a lot of these, you know, factory set cameras. So that was a clear case where the FBI, you know, could have gotten out in front of that because they were so overwhelmed by this massive investigation that is unlike anything they've seen before. I think they missed their window for getting potentially more video evidence that could have been helpful for them ultimately finding who is responsible for those bombs.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, I'll talk with Ryan Riley about some of the amateur online sleuths who have been helping to solve some of these cases. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. Welcome back to All the President's Lawyers. I'm Josh Barrow. Ken White is on vacation this week, and I'm here with Ryan Riley, who covers the Justice Department and lately the Capitol riot cases for HuffPost. Ryan, I want to talk about how these investigations are being done at such scale, the role of technology, and also the role of citizen investigators who have been taking the mounds of publicly available photos and video from the riot and the wanted flyers that are put out by the FBI looking for specific people who were present at the riot, and these people who are working on the internet trying to identify some of these possible subjects. That's actually playing a role in some of these cases, right? People are doing this research on the internet, figuring out who some of these people are, calling the FBI and saying, I figured out who this is. And sometimes with a significant lag, the FBI seems to be actually acting on that information.
Completely, yeah. And it's this interesting situation because now a lot of these online sleuths who've been doing this work for a while have their own individual relationships with FBI agents. So one of the frustrations early on was that they were sending this sort of to this portal on the internet. At one point, you could upload documents, and then they took away that capability because they were getting too much data that they were having trouble storing. And then it was just a matter of text, and then you'd have to tell them if you had evidence that you wanted to turn over, and then the FBI would have to follow up with you, and hopefully you saved that evidence or it's in your screenshots from several months ago. So I think logistically, this was just something that the FBI wasn't really prepared to handle, something on this sort of scale. But now that those individual relationships have been established in some cases with FBI agents, there's a little bit more of a feedback loop. But that's one of the things that has really frustrated a lot of these sleuths, is that they're sending over all this information to the FBI, but there's not really any response, or there's not any even any indication that it's been received. They have no clue what happens for it, and they just have to wait around for months, and they're not knowing whether someone is actually working on their case or whether it's sitting in an inbox somewhere, never to be seen again. And that's a real sense of frustration for a lot of these sleuths. You know, one of these online sleuths was sort of jokingly saying that they should take a page out of Domino's book and basically have a tracker app, right? So it's like, okay, you've sent in your tip now. It's been assigned to this agent, you know, and then sort of jokingly saying, oh, now you can watch, you know, on Google Maps as they sort of go and arrest the guy that you turned in. I do think that that's something that the FBI struggled with because they haven't been able to turn over, typically they don't turn over information about an ongoing investigation. But that's really been a sense of frustration, and they really do want to keep these sleuths motivated. They've put out statements about that, and they appreciate the public's help. And I think more recently, you've seen more indications of direct citations of the sedition hunters in a lot of these FBI affidavits, whereas before they might have hid the ball a little bit or just said, oh, we found this on the internet. This is on the internet. Now they'll say, you know, based on this tweet from sedition hunters or based on this tweet from this person, you know, we found this video, or make sure to mention sedition hunters in some way to sort of keep them motivated, because, you know, they're not doing this for any money. They're doing this because they're motivated to want to bring these people to justice.
Who are these people, the so-called sedition hunters? Who spends their time doing this?
It's a real mixed bag. I mean, I've sort of bonded with a few of them with my own talking about kids and, you know, during the pandemic, and we've had a little bit of a bonding over how difficult it's been to get kids through the pandemic. But that's been something that I've talked to mothers and fathers. There's one mother who's been, you know, homeschooling her kid throughout this throughout the pandemic, and was doing this sort of on the side after her kid went to bed, and just zeroing in on someone and trying to find everyone. And they're all bringing different technological tool sets to the table. One woman is a very good Facebook sleuth and was saying that earlier she used to sort of do this on behalf of her friends. Whenever they had a new man, she would sort of look into their Facebook and try to get a little bit about them. And now she's turned that skill that she acquired towards this this broader sedition hunt. So it's been really interesting just to, you know, and then there are, of course, a lot of people who are more really technologically savvy and have organized websites that put this information in a really readable and digestible format. There are people who are organizing, creating hashtags, because that's one thing that the FBI hasn't done is create hashtags, which would generate a lot more media attention if they were really looking for someone. That's something that the FBI does with, you know, someone who robs a bank. But I think because of politics, there's been a lot more hesitancy to do any sort of hashtags or nicknames around any Trump supporters or making fun of them in any way, because I think that could obviously create a lot of blowback. But that's something that has been helpful for the FBI in the past. So what the sedition hunters have done is sort of do that on their own and come up with these catchy nicknames, because it helps people remember who these people were. So when they're looking through a video, they're not going to remember, oh, this is number 7, you know, this is number 345 on the FBI's wanted list. But they are going to remember, oh, this is the guy, this is that guy we gave that funny nickname because he has this hat on, or he has this beard, or he looks like this, right? There's one guy, it came out recently, who kind of resembles Conan O'Brien, and they gave him the nickname Conan O'Riot, which instantly, now when you see that guy with orange hair in the crowd, you're going to be like, oh, that's Conan O'Riot. And then they can tag what he did, tag where he is at this moment, tag what he was doing there.
Because, you know, I understand how this has been useful in these investigations, but it always makes me a little nervous when people are like, oh, the internet is on this. And people are, you know, out there on Twitter figuring out who these people are. Because I don't know that I've seen this in the Capitol riot cases, but in other instances, you see incorrect identifications of people. Some name will go around the internet and it's just someone who looks like the person in the photo. It's not actually the person in the photo. Has that been an issue here at all? And I know you talk a little bit about sort of like almost informal codes of conduct about how the sleuths are supposed to operate in order to avoid problems like that?
Yeah, you know, very early on, it was a problem with a couple of cases where someone was falsely identified. But it was interesting because it was sort of this self-policing measure. And I think the biggest example of this is, of course, after the Boston Marathon bombing, where we had someone identified who was not a subject, who was not a target, who was not the perpetrator. And that's just, I mean, that was basically because of Reddit, that was how that sort of unfolded. What you've seen here is you've seen sort of this effort. Very early on, there was an effort to make sure no one posted names. That's been broken in some capacities where if they're very sure of an ID, sometimes they've just come out with the names. You can't police everything on this. But there is a big hesitancy about posting names to this moment, unless someone has sort of identified themselves on their own. And then that's sort of when the dam breaks. But it is sort of this interestingly enforced rule that I think a lot of people in this community have adopted and in large part adhered to, not naming people publicly on social media because it might hurt these ongoing cases.
Can we also talk about the role of facial recognition software? I know that the government has been using that here. I've seen a lot of cases where it's like they seem to be using that in a supporting capacity where they have other more traditional types of evidence about an identification, and then they also run it through facial recognition software and it matches, or vice versa. They have someone that they find through facial recognition software, but then they go back and they find, you know, here's an Instagram photo of him that positively identifies him as this person associated with this person, et cetera. So what role has it been playing here, and is it being used in any way that's likely to end up being controversial in the cases?
Yeah, I mean, actually, it's in some cases, in a case that came out yesterday, it was sort of outsourced, and that's been a major component of it because there's websites you can go to that sort of do this for the public, and you can find any photos of people online. You know, it's been actually a little bit creepy because someone has run it on me and has found photos of me reporting at the Capitol myself, not on January 6th, but just in a hearing, or I'm in the background of some photo I'm in the back of a group of reporters. And it's incredible how well it is able to pick up just, you know, the measurements between my eyes and my nose and my mouth, and like, oh, there I am in the back of the room, even though I'm sort of out of focus. But that's me.
Wow.
It's been really incredible. But how the Sedition Hunters community sort of thinks of this is as a lead that then they can follow up on and come up with some other information to sort of match up with. So I think that that's how they're sort of thinking of this. From the FBI side, it's been used as that lead to begin with, but then they can also match that up with those cell phone tower pings. They can match it up with the returns they get off of subpoenaing someone's social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I saw LinkedIn in one case. that's something that they – I think they were just happy to be included. But that's something that they can use that information and then match it up with a better ID. And then they'll get somebody else, probably someone they know or that someone they are connected with on social media to confirm that identification. Or hopefully they found some communication, even if it was a private message that said someone, yeah, here's I was at the Capitol, or they sent a photo to them. The craziest case, I think, with this was this guy who actually was pretty – he wasn't on social media very much, but he knocked over a police officer, a female police officer, and gave her a concussion at the barriers very early on during this attack. He actually didn't – this is sort of incredible because he's a 30-something – year old man, and like I think, you know, was a millennial, but didn't have his own cell phone. But he brought his girlfriend's cell phone with him to the Capitol, and then went back home. And what the FBI was able to do was run a facial recognition program that picked up a photo that was posted on his girlfriend's public Instagram of him. And they used that photo of him at the Capitol, found that ping on his girlfriend's Instagram. And because that was such like a different way that they went about doing this, then they actually sent in undercover FBI agents who walked into the convenience store where he worked and started talking with him about the riot and got him to admit he was there and it was crazy. And that was how they sort of pieced that together. So that's not, it's, they're very rarely are they, I don't even think ever have they used a case that's built on facial recognition alone. They've always had that other admission, that other component. But it is a tremendously powerful tool that really narrows the window of potential suspects in a lot of these cases.
And then what about all that cell phone data? I found it remarkable. It's not just that the cell phone can put you in the Capitol, that they're able to put you in a very specific location in the Capitol based on the cell phone data. It's that granular?
Yeah, because I think this isn't my expertise, but I think that because of how thick I think the Capitol building is, there's a lot of towers inside of it. So they can triangulate basically a pretty definitive location for where you are inside the Capitol based on, you know, your reception at the time, what towers you were pinging in at the time. But you look at these maps and they've been able to trace people. Okay, they were in the rotunda. Okay, they went over here. They went over to the House side. They went over to the Senate side with pretty high specificity. And then they can, of course, they have, you know, the Capitol is very covered by closed caption video. So they've been able to match up and say, okay, this person was in that place and say, oh, there they are, and then follow them throughout the crowd. And facial recognition has been a big component internally as well, not only for identifying people, but based on the data that they already have, it makes it a lot easier when you're talking about hundreds of suspects to say, oh, this face is associated with that person. So you can just trace them. And here's all the evidence of them throughout the entire incident.
I just want to go back and note your description of that case with the undercover agents who spoke with the guy at the convenience store where he worked. He knocked over a female cop, gave her a concussion. I think that some of the discussion that we've had about the Capitol riot over the last few months as we've gotten farther away from it has abstracted away from this sort of thing, that it's not just people who went in with some elaborate plan about how they were specifically going to overthrow the U.S. government who committed serious crimes. This was, there were violent acts here that even if they were impromptu or incidental, caused significant injury to people and caused significant hazard to people. And it's just sort of crazy to me how that's being abstracted away as, the riot wasn't that bad because it wasn't going to be an actual overthrow of the U.S. government. You know, there are still very serious crimes that you can commit, very serious problems that can exist, even if you're engaged in a very shambolic form of insurrection that is not actually going to change the control of the U.S. government. I think once you get into the specifics of at least some of these cases, and I realize there are lots of these other cases where people just sort of went in and paraded around and did not give any concussions to police officers, but there were really significant violent crimes committed here.
Yeah, completely. And I think that that's like, I don't want to, both sides it in any way, but I do think that that's something that people on the right have, of course, came up with their idea of what happened on January 6th. And it's very limited. And it's, okay, look at these people who are walking in between the ropes. They were just, look at this old granny protesting, right? But they're ignoring all of these extraordinarily violent attacks and the dozens and dozens and dozens of injuries that officers sustained that day. And the really violent attacks that we saw, especially on the western side of the Capitol. I think, on the left, there is this, among some people, I think there's this desire to really throw the book at everyone. And I think that you really have to think about this and think this through about how you want to handle these cases. I don't think that people should really be outraged about somebody getting, a couple of months or even probation if they just, all they did was enter the Capitol. If they didn't cross that threshold of violence, you have to think logically about how you would want to handle these cases. There are some judges who have been upset about how DOJ has approached these cases. And I think that there is definitely a component of this is certainly that DOJ just doesn't have the resources to bring all of these to trial. And already, we obviously know that that guilty pleas are a huge component of how federal cases are handled. That's basically the standard, is some sort of guilty plea or some sort of plea deal. But I think that also has an influence here in that the DOJ doesn't have the resources. But you also have to think about what actually happened in context and realize that there were some people who showed up that day and you saw this big crowd going in, didn't have any clue what they were doing. Some of them didn't know. One guy didn't even know. He thought he was at the White House when he was at the Capitol, right? And I think that, so I think that that's something you have to keep in mind, is that if they didn't cross that threshold of violence, if they entered with a sign, are we really going to throw the book at them and, try to slap them with a felony? Or are we going to have a measured response to that is proportional to the conduct?
Let's leave it there for today. Ryan Riley is senior justice reporter at HuffPost. Ryan, you're also working on a book on this, right? Called Sedition Hunters?
Yeah. I'm working on a book. Hopefully it'll be, we're looking at early 2023 because we have to go to, a lot of these cases are going to take a while to go to trial, but it's something that I think it's really an interesting pivot point for the FBI about, you know, how this online sleuthing works and how the government's handling domestic terrorism.
I very much look forward to that. Ryan, thank you for your reporting and thank you for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you have questions, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also send us a question at kcrw.com/ATPL. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our production fellow is Nisha Venkin. The show is recorded and mixed by John Meek, and Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and Ken White and I will be back next week with more of All the President's Lawyers.